Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing, Charlie?
Pretty normal day.
I think Andy and I need to raise the energy level.
Sorry about that.
Josh, you raise the energy level?
Here, I'll start off with a joke. Which book of the Bible is only 80% truth?
Ruth.
You got it.
Oh, my goodness.
That's pretty impressive.
Do you get it?
It broke Tim's head.
But it took a long time.
Four out of five is 80%, and that's four letters of the word truth is Ruth. I feel like it makes it better if you explain it.
It does.
It does. I'm glad you did. I didn't get it completely. I only got
So I'm not arguing for a YouTube version of this podcast, but I do wish we could have seen Tim's head just jerk back. Oh, boom.
All right. So here is what is in this episode. We are going to have no controversy at all. Just be really simple. Things that everybody agrees on. And that's after we do books and business.
That's what we call in the business a teaser.
Foreshadowing. All right. Are we ready?
Books and business.
Go for it.
So I have been reading Millard Erickson's Christian Theology. Millard Erickson is a Baptist. And so his Christian theology is a lot of stuff that we would agree with. He has an entire section on humanity, and I've been reading this with a group of men at our church. It's called like a path group, men that are interested. They're not interested. They're pursuing pastoral ministry. And in this group, there's two different editions of Erickson's Christian theology that is being read. There's a small, what is it called?
Christian Doctrine.
Introducing Christian Doctrine. It's very good. It's like a shorter version of his full theology of Christian theology. And it's been interesting, too, to see what makes the cut. Because, if you're going to make like an abbreviated version of something, what do you delete? In part five on humanity, by the way, I think this is a good theology, and I would recommend it, but I want to talk about something about it that I didn't like. Sometimes we kind of talk about all the stuff that we don't like, and so you get the idea that thing is bad, but this is a good systematic theology. So chapter 24, the universality of humanity, was completely omitted in the abbreviated edition, which I thought was really fascinating. In that chapter, you have basically the complementarian egalitarian discussion. So again, interesting that that chapter gets axed. But even still, I think Erickson illustrates one of the issues that I have with modern evangelicalism when it comes to complementarianism and egalitarianism. He has a quote here, and in the section, he's basically saying, hey, listen, men and women are equal, but then he still has to deal with some of the scripture passages that seem to communicate that they're not equal. So for example, I think his handling of Genesis 3:28 was pretty decent. Genesis 3:28 reads, there is neither Jew nor Gentile, neither slave nor free, nor is there male or female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. So this verse is like everywhere within egalitarian literature, and they say, look, we are equal, and there's no difference between men and women. However, they fail to realize that the text does say neither slave nor free. So does that mean that Paul was arguing that there's no longer any slaves? And obviously then everybody starts to think, it's like, no, he didn't argue that exactly. See, this passage is talking about ontology. So this whole content is going to be on genders in Genesis again. So maybe you need to go back and listen to my first episode, but ontology, there's no difference before God between a slave or a free person, a rich or a poor person, or a man and a woman. They're equal. So what does Erickson say? He states, probably the most direct declaration that women stand on the same footing as men in the sight of God, as far as salvation is concerned, is the classic text in Galatians 3:28. So I applaud him because what does he do? He interprets that verse in light of its context. What Paul is talking about is salvation. So he does very well. He then states this verse is sometimes taken out of context and used to address issues that Paul is not talking about. Exactly. And that is what I'm kind of pushing against all the time. But at the same time, within the entire section, there's like this aura, like where he's trying to make things better.
Palatable
for the modern.
Politically correct.
Yeah, politically correct. Okay, so for example, he then talks about Genesis 2, and he talks about the word helper, which we talked about in the last episode when I did this genders and Genesis thing. He notes this would, let's see here. Genesis 2:18 is not inferior in essence to the one helped. Rather, the helper is to be thought of as a co-worker or enabler, a helper. To be sure, the Hebrew word Baal, meaning Lord or Master, is frequently used for a husband. And so he's right on, I think, with the whole helper thing, but then he has to deal with, well, what is up with this language that a man is the Baal, the Lord or the Master, which is frequent terminology in the Old Testament. So then this is how he deals with this. It should be observed, however, that the feminine of that word also appears in Genesis 20 and verse 3, for example. It is used to describe Sarah's relationship to Abraham. Thus, whatever the nature of the rule in the marital relationship, it is not unilateral. I thought that was a really interesting statement. And what did it do? It drove me to my Bible. Like, what does this passage actually say? So Genesis 20 and verse 3, it reads, "But God came to Abimelech." This is the whole scene where Abraham, he says, tells Sarah, "Sarah, say you're my sister." And then Abimelech goes and is going to marry her. And so we have a bit of an issue. Because she's married to Abraham. And Genesis 20, verse 3, "But God came to Abimelech in a dream by night and said to him, 'Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife.'" So the phrase there, "for she is a man's wife," okay, she is married to a man, is the Hebrew. And the word Baal is used to refer to a woman, but it's in relationship to her husband. She is, let's see here, how do I say this in English? It's just like a husband's, a man's Baal, like the master. Anyway, it's not doing what he's saying at all. All right. The word Baal is in the feminine, but it's being used in a verbal way. And so it's basically just saying she is the one that's married to a Baal, a man, a husband. So there is a feminine form of Baal, but it's a verbal use, and it's not even talking about her exerting some kind of authority over. It's the verbal use to marry. Go ahead.
Is this like maybe similar to how we talk about the president's wife being like the first lady? Like, it's not giving her, it's just saying like, she's like, would that be something similar? Because it's not like she doesn't have authority over her husband because of that. It's just like a position she has because she's married to the president.
Yes.
Okay.
A position that she has because she's married to him. She is the Baal.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The verb, it means to marry, and it's the verb Baal as a verb means to marry. And then the noun Baal means master or lord. So what he's saying is it's Ba'alah, like a feminine master or lord, and that's not what the text has. What the text has is a feminine participle, and it's referring to the verb to marry, and so she is one married to a Ba'al. Wow. So it's got absolutely nothing to do with what he's saying.
Why do you think Erickson can't just himself go and look at the Hebrew the way that you did and see that that word is not the word that's used?
Him up. You just wound him. Oh man, watch out. What are you going to say about theologians, Tim?
I mean,
they're not poets.
is the allure of the inner circle or the inner ring so strong that you have to be dishonest in your scholarship?
I mean, that's what it felt like here. And so it was kind of funny because I came kind of a little amped up finding this in this reading. And then we got together as a pastor's group and we came to this chapter and I wanted to mention it. And guess where it was in their books?
Nowhere.
It wasn't there.
The same place women pastors are in the Bible.
So in the shorter edition, they completely evaded the whole issue by cutting the chapter out. Anyway, that was kind of a long books and business, but Christian Theology by Millard Erickson, it kind of sets us up for the content later.
Well, for my books and business, I'm just going to read a poem because I can do what I want.
Well played, Josh. Well played.
Actually,
you remembered before we recorded, wait, I have free will.
So actually a listener, my good friend Andrew Schaff, sent me a text message last week and said that he really enjoyed reading George Herbert's poem Constancy. And so I thought I will read that because it is worth hearing and it's encouragement, particularly to men. And because we're talking about the roles of men today, I thought it would be fitting. So the whole poem is in response to the first line, which is the question, who is the honest man? And the title of the poem is Constancy. So you're thinking about what does it mean to be a steadfast man? I'm just going to read it and then we're going to go on. Who is the honest man? He that doth still and strongly good pursue to God, his neighbor, and himself most true, whom neither force nor fawning can unpin or wrench from giving all their due, whose honesty is not so loose or easy that a ruffling wind can blow away or glittering look it blind, who rides his sure and even trot while the world now rides by, now lags behind, who, when great trials come, nor seeks nor shuns them, but doth calmly stay till he the thing and the example weigh, all being brought into a sum, what place or person calls for, he doth pay. Whom none can work or woo to use in anything a trick or sleight, for above all things he abhors deceit. His words and works and fashion too all of a piece, and all are clear and straight. Who never melts or thaws at close temptations, when the day is done, his goodness sets not, but in the dark can run. The sun to others writeth laws, and is their virtue. Virtue is his sun. Who, when he is to treat with sick folks, women, those whom passions sway, allows for that, and keeps his constant way. Whom others' faults do not defeat, but though men fail him, yet his part doth play. Whom nothing can procure when the wide world runs by us, from his will to writhe his limbs and share not mend the ill. This is the mark man, safe and sure, who still is right and prays to be so still. So I know it's somewhat archaic language at times, but I hope that's encouraging to you. I do encourage you to go look at the poem again and read it, and you will be encouraged by it.
It's very appropriate considering even the content of this episode. So there's even a quote in there I might have you read later when we go through the episode. Thank you.
So last week we walked through the inner ring, and as I was looking at my copy of The Weight of Glory, the next essay is called Membership. It's one of the essays that we're not covering. But I'm going to try to cover the rest of those in Books and Business. And so I thought, oh, I'll go through this. So this is an essay where Lewis, I thought, oh, inner ring and now membership. I wonder if he's going to talk about something related. It's not actually related, but he's dealing with groups you're involved in, sort of, but bigger issues. So when he starts off, he talks about sort of the way the world, the secular world, tries to box out Christianity. And his main argument is that the age that he lived in, which is going to sound a lot like our age, it had this idea that religion belongs in your private life. And so he said that is, in fact, an occupation. They would say that is like religion should be an occupation for an individual's hour of leisure. However, he said this is at once paradoxical, dangerous, and natural. It's paradoxical. And he kind of explains how essentially, if you really make your religion private, it's saying your religion can have no effect out in the world. And he identifies that well. He says this is actually, he thinks, one of the enemy's strategies is to put religion in a private place because then it doesn't have to affect anybody else. So he's sort of walking through that in this article. And it's one of those that I read it once, and I think I'm going to need to read it three or four times to get it. But there is a section I want to read where he talks about he's talking about how religion plays out and whatnot. So I'm just going to read this long quote. But listen to how he walks through this issue. Now, understand Lewis is writing this in like the 50s, 40s, something like that. All right, he says this. And now I must say something that may appear to you to be a paradox. You have often heard that though in the world we hold different stations, yet we are all equal in the sight of God. There are, of course, senses in which this is true. God is no acceptor of persons. His love for us is not measured by our social rank or intellectual talents. But I believe there is a sense in which this maxim is the reverse of the truth. I'm going to venture to say that artificial equality is necessary in the life of the state, but that in the church, we strip off this disguise. We recover our real inequalities and thereby are refreshed and quickened. I do believe in political equality, but there are two opposite reasons for being a Democrat. Now, pause real quick. I don't think he means a Democrat and a Republican like us. I think he's saying he follows democracy, not communism. Okay, back to the quote. He says, "You may think all men so good that they deserve a share in the government of the Commonwealth, and so wise that the Commonwealth needs their advice. That is, in my opinion, the false romantic doctrine of democracy. On the other hand, you may believe fallen men to be so wicked that not one of them can be trusted with any irresponsible power over his fellows. That, I believe, is the true ground of democracy. I do not believe that God created an egalitarian world. I believe the authority of the parent over the child, the husband over the wife, the learned over the simple, to have been as much a part of the original plan as the authority of man over beast. I believe that if we had not fallen, Filmer, the some guy, would be right. And patriarchal monarchy would be the sole lawful government. But since we have learned sin, we have found, as Lord Acton says, that all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. The only remedy has been to take away the powers and substitute a legal fiction of equality. The authority of the father and the husband has been rightly abolished on the legal plane. Not because this authority is in and of itself bad. On the contrary, it is, I hold, divine in origin. But because fathers and husbands are bad. Theocracy has rightly been abolished. Not because it is bad that learned priests should govern ignorant laymen. But because priests are wicked men like the rest of us. Even the authority of man over beast has had to be interfered with because it is constantly abused." And I just thought that was very, he says, equality is for me in the same position as clothes. It is the result of the fall and the remedy of it. I thought that was really fascinating. And I don't know how many Lewis fanboys out there know that he thinks that. I'm like, wow, that is like pretty, pretty, pretty good and pretty direct. So anyways, I thought that was a really interesting take on this is how it should be, but because we're sinners, we have to have this democracy idea. But if that all went away, it would be a patriarchal monarchy. Fascinating.
Very much. Where was that again?
Membership. So it's the next essay over from the one we read last time.
In
and
Way
it's
of
on
Glory.
Page. Come on, Kindle. Get to the page number. I don't have page. Oh, it's page 161.
So, Charlie, what are you going to do to set up Tim's discussion?
Hey, that was not planned, by the way. That was not planned at all. I was like, hey, this is the next song on cover.
I'm going to do nothing. I do not think that that is going to make it into Greta's Netflix C.S. Lewis
no.
adaptation.
I agree with you. It is funny to... Never mind.
So I have a lot... I have a mixed bag of what I could do for Books and Business here. What do you guys... Do you want me to do something... serious?
Give us our options, Charlie, and we'll vote.
No, so just you follow your heart.
I can tell you what I've been reading. Follow my heart? Well, okay, if we're going to do that, then I'm going to read the sonnet that I wrote. I will. Before I do that, I will just throw in a teaser for next week's episode. So I'm going to read a quote. I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. What is that from?
C.S. Lewis.
Meditations in a Tool Shed, right? God in the Dock?
It's the last line of Is Theology Poetry.
Oh. That's Is Theology Poetry. No way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's a super famous quote.
It surprised me too because...
I think it's also in Meditations.
I think, yeah. I think it's in multiple spots. I had to double took on it. And I was like, I did not think that was in this. But I have a copy of it right here. Oxford Socratic Club, 1944, Is Theology Poetry, and sure enough, it is the last line of it. So, as a teaser for next week, I will just read, presented with no comment, what I've called sonnet number 3.
Charlie, I love it when you present things with no comment.
Well, we're not going to comment. We're not going to comment. And I think I have, so... ABBA, and then, so technically it would have to be ABBA twice, right?
Thanks for the comment.
It's a pre-comment.
Yes, if you're writing an Italian, it would be
okay,
ABBA.
So this is ABBA, and then it's CDDC. So the rhyming's not perfect.
Well, when you're an established poet, you can play around with the form. So there you go, Charlie.
Okay, so...
I mean, it's not as though this is sonnet number 1.
It's not.
This is sonnet number three. So go wild.
That's what we're doing.
And this is how we make Tim like poetry.
All right. Sonnet number 3. The year was gold, full, bright with flowers fair, when sunflowers abounded full and free. No other year has stayed so close to me, nor cast such golden beams upon the air. When I behold a flower, my mind takes flight and wonders how one ever missed its face. We pass it by, dismissing all its grace, yet find it shining always in our sight. True beauty never fades when left unseen. Its fullness lingers pure and ever true. But passing by, we wound the heart and soul. A pain the flower feels not, yet I have known. Go chase its bloom before the light is through. Behold its glow and make thy spirit whole. Sonnet number 3.
Beautiful.
Let's have a conversation about genders in Genesis. In theory, this would be a lesson or section, or if this turns into a book, number 3, you might be like, I thought genders in Genesis was like a few weeks ago. Yes.
So what I love about this is your notes are written on the back of a Hebrew quiz.
Yes, they are.
I was hoping that would like be a student's quiz and it's like graded on one side and then you like flipped it over and you're like, no, let's do some podcasts.
In a hole there lived a hobbit.
Yeah, exactly.
That had a broken, fractured family.
So episode 279 is really the episode you need to listen to first. So that was Genders in Genesis, and we worked through Genesis 2:15-20. Kind of the subtitle for that one was God's Design for Men and Women as Image Bearing Co-Laborers. Session number 2 would be episode 175.
What?
what? Okay, so I talked about Genesis 2, 25 through 21 through 25 and what it means to be one flesh. Marriage, contract, or covenant is the name of that episode. And so in theory, that should be episode number 2.
That was episode 175.
Episode 175. So now we're moving past that and we're into Genesis chapter 3. And this one I've called Fractured Families. Genders in Genesis, the subtitle would then be Fractured Families. So we are going to get into the Bible. We'll be in Genesis chapter 3. And as we think through this passage, I just want us to recall we're also connecting to some instruction in the New Testament. For example, 1 Timothy 2, 11 through 14. This is one of Paul's grenade passages where he kind of just blows everything up. And it reads, "Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. And I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression." So, verse 13, "For Adam was formed first, then Eve," that's Genesis 2. And then verse 14, "And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression," is Genesis 3. So we're going to go look at Genesis, and we want to ask a couple of questions, and these questions are going to make us feel a little bit uncomfortable. In fact, I want to just remind you, when I was just reading through all of that, that was the Bible. That wasn't me. That was the Bible. Okay, that was 1 Timothy 2, 11 through 14, and we don't need to hide. Okay, we don't need to try to acquiesce to our culture. We need to let the Bible communicate what the Bible's communicating. And what I say in this session probably be some new information for a lot of you, and you may not like it or you may not accept it. I would encourage you to go to your Bible, write us, say where I'm wrong. Okay, but you think through what the Bible has to say and go to Genesis 3 and study it out for yourself. And then the other thing I want us to consider is there's something different about women that makes them more susceptible to deception. We don't like thinking about that. We don't even like that question. But we do have Genesis 3 in the Bible, and we also have Genesis or 1 Timothy 2:14. And Paul states, "And Adam was not deceived, but the woman, being deceived, fell into transgression." So let's think about these things as we move into Genesis chapter 3. And we're going to read the Bible. I like reading the Bible. I recognize a lot of you are already familiar with the story, but I'm going to ask Josh to start us off, and if you could read the first 6 verses.
"Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate."
You're familiar with the story. The fall of man. It's kind of interesting that we use the terminology the fall of man because man functions as a synecdoche for all of humanity. The terminology we've used throughout the ages is based upon man being the head, and man was the one that faltered, and that's what Paul teaches as well. As we take a look at Genesis 3:6, we actually learn a little bit more about man and even some of the natural tendencies of men. In Genesis 3:6, it states that the woman saw that the tree was good for food, it was pleasant to the eyes, it was desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and we often miss this little part, but then it says, she also gave to her husband with her. The "with her" is in the Hebrew text. He is right with her as he watches everything play out. Commentators have noted this, people talk about it, and it's like, Adam, why didn't you do something? The text actually explains a little bit why Adam didn't do anything. He was right there. He should have intervened. It was his responsibility to intervene as the head of the human race. This was his job. Okay, so Paul knows this. The woman is tricked, but Adam is not tricked at all. He chooses to do what his wife says. Now, there are a lot of things in Genesis 3 that we could work through, but I can't take the time to go through everything. We're going to go down now to verses, we'll do 15 through 19. Andy, can you read Genesis 3, 15 through 19?
This is the Lord speaking. He says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. To the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth your children. Your desire shall be contrary to your husband, but he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and if eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. For you are dust, and to dust you shall return.
So I had Andy read a few more verses, the ending of the curse of the serpent. And Genesis 3:15 is a very important theological verse. It's called the Proto-Evangelium, the first reference to the gospel that God is going to bruise or crush the serpent's head. He will right what has been wronged. So that's a very key verse, but it is not part of our discussion today. Genesis 3:16, we will be talking about a little bit, but this is not the curse against the woman. We need to be careful with our terminology. Because the serpent is cursed, people then take that terminology and apply it to the woman and even to the man. The woman is not cursed, she is judged. In her judgment, it concerns her children and her husband. And that's going to be an important part of the conversation. That's going to be later. What I want us to focus in right now on is Adam. It states in Genesis 3:17, then to Adam he said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife. And Andy was reading from the English Standard Version, I believe. And so it states in the ESV, because you listened to your wife. The key word here is the verb listened. So the New King James, translating it heeded, kind of has the connotation of obeyed. Mm-hmm. The NET Bible, yeah, it translates it explicitly, because you obeyed your wife. The verb that's used there is shema. This is a common word in the Hebrew Bible. I've talked about it on multiple occasions, even on our podcast. If you remember Deuteronomy 6:4, you have the shema. It's the same Hebrew word that's used here. So I'm going to present this information kind of how I discovered things. And what I discovered was only about 6 months ago. So I am still learning. And, you know, you might not like what I have to say. Well, be gracious to me and study it out for yourself. And you tell me, you know, where I'm wrong. But you explicitly have a reference here to what Adam did wrong before he ate of the fruit. And what did he do wrong? He obeyed his wife. Or if you take Shema, he listened to his wife. And that's an interesting description. It's an interesting description about the world pre-fall. What does it mean? Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I have commanded you. All right, we're going to talk about that a little bit more, and this is an important part of this entire discussion. You need to wrestle with Genesis 3:17, and then you need to think through even the natural inclinations of men. There's a book that I was reading that was not a very good book. It was an egalitarian book. I've been studying reading books on masculinity. The name of the book was The Men We Need. It wasn't terrible. It had a lot of good stuff, but he definitely did not lay out a biblical masculinity, okay, because it was much more about egalitarianism. And he has a quote in the book, and he states, passive men are a far more common problem than men who are overbearing, physically intimidating, or the other usual things we considered examples of toxic masculinity. Now, I bring this quote up for two reasons, okay? One is to note his observation. What is he having to deal with all the time as he's seeking to encourage men to be men? And the answer is apathy. We as men have a general tendency to be lazy. I see it in my boys. I see it in other people. And I'm constantly trying to encourage men to be diligent. God has given you a task, a mission of some sort. And if you don't even know what it is, just start doing something, move forward, and we'll see where the journey goes. But we have a tendency to be like, I'm good. I'm going to go play video games, or I'm going to go enjoy this kind of amusement. As you look at the book of Proverbs, what are the two sins that the young man struggles with? Laziness, okay, apathy. If they can get away with being a bum, then they will. So easy money and easy woman. Easy money allows them to be lazy, and then easy woman, and speaking of sexuality. So passive men are a problem. And it's a significant problem within our culture. And that's something that we need to take more seriously. Now, the second reason I bring this quote up is because people often portray these two things as two ditches. And it's like, well, we need to, you know, it's like everybody was overbearing and domineering 50 years ago, and now everybody's apathetic. And it's like these two ditches. It's not two ditches. What it is it's two sinful responses. That's what it is. And there's some men whose natural tendency is apathy, and there's some men whose natural tendency is to be overbearing, to be a jerk. They're unkind, and they're not Christ-like to their wives. And what we're seeking to encourage is Christ-likeness. So when we go through this, I'm going to be arguing more against the apathy ditch. I am not advocating for the overbearing ditch. I am advocating for the Ephesians 5 Christ-like pattern that God has given us.
Can I offer a thought or ask you a question?
Go for it. Because
I like this, but the ditch analogy helps sometimes when the right answer is in between the two possibilities. Where the ditch analogy, I think, goes awry is, and I like that you're saying these are two sinful responses, when you use the ditch analogy, it automatically makes you think that balance is the good place. And balance is never, ever a virtue to pursue, ever. You pursue truth, and sometimes there's balance. But like, for example, if you murdered one person a month ago and you murdered 10 people 2 months ago, you don't want balance this month and to just murder 5 people. You want the virtue of doing this. So I like what you said there, because it's not like, well, we need to in between these two. We need to actually just pursue the actual paradigm that you're going to present. So is that fair?
That's very fair. So okay. Andy, you really illustrated the problem with like the balance idea, because it's like, oh, are we going over to, we need to be more overbearing, because we're being too apathetic. Wrong answer. We don't want overbearing men, okay? Nor do we want apathetic. Or you're overbearing. You need to be more apathetic. No, that's not the answer to. Thank you for that clarification. That was very helpful. So apathy is a significant issue. And then you have, as an example, what happens when the man is apathetic. And what did Eve do? She ate from the tree. She was tricked, and we need to wrestle with that, by the way. What is up with her being tricked, and what does Paul have to say about that? And then we have the headship of the woman, and that's what you see in verses and through the entire scene, the woman's headship. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about some Hebrew words to help us just understand a little bit about the judgments that are then corresponding. This is going to be important when it comes to 1 Timothy 2. So man, okay, Adam, he comes from the ground. And what's the Hebrew word for ground?
Adama.
Adam comes from Adama. Now, another word for man is ish. And what's the name for woman?
Isha.
So you have Adam coming from Adama and ish, Isha coming from ish. As you look at then the corresponding judgments in this passage, they both correspond from the thing from which they were taken. In Genesis 3:16, to the woman he says, I will greatly multiply your sorrow and your conception, so her children, so the things that are coming out of her, but then your desire will be for your husband. So it's directly related to the one from whom she has come. And then, and with Adam, it's the ground that's cursed. Adam is never cursed. It's the ground that is cursed. So his judgment is directly related to the thing from which he came as well. Now I want to highlight something. The woman was created to help the man. Her primary role is relational. She's helping him. Her judgment then similarly concerns her relationships. Now, this is fascinating when you consider 1 Timothy chapter 2. So 1 Timothy 2, what does Paul say? Okay, the woman was deceived. She was the one that was tricked. So what does that then mean? And does this relationship thing connect in any way to the deception of the woman? So I'm going to read some things just for us to kind of think through positions here. So this is from Schreiner. Did you have something? This is from Schreiner in his article, Interpretation of 1 Timothy 2, 9 through 15, which, by the way, there's like tons of literature on 1 Timothy 2. All right, I have not read it all. But here's what Schreiner says. The consequences of allowing women in the authoritative teaching office for their gentler and kinder nature inhibits them from excluding people from doctrinal error. Women are less likely to perceive the need to take a stand on doctrinal non-negotiables since they prize harmonious relationships more than men do. So it's kind of fascinating that Genesis 3:16, the judgment of the woman concerns her relationships, specifically with her husband and then her children. It is commonly understood, just even in the social sciences, that women are more compassionate and they are more concerned about relationships. Schreiner is then taking that insight, which I could then, I think, back up from Genesis 3:16, and he applies it to Paul's instruction. And this is then a reason why a woman shouldn't be in an authoritative office in the church, because the prizing of relationships is going to be detrimental to the doctrinal integrity of the organization. How are we doing? This then leads her to then be more easily tricked. Now, that is a generalization. Now, I want to push back on the other side of things a little bit. Is it valuable that we have women who are compassionate and who are invested with helping people? Absolutely. So here's a quote from Abigail Dodds in her article, The Beauty and Abuse of Empathy. And she notes, research shows that women in particular are more empathetic than men when seeing other people in pain. I think this reflects a wonderful design feature that God has given woman that benefits not only any children we might have, but our entire communities. A woman who is sensitive to the feelings of others, especially their pain, will be a sort of first responder. She is able to move toward the hurting. She can sound the alarm that someone is in need. And very practically for mothers, she can sense her infant's need for food and sleep and attention. Mothers do this. It's kind of odd, this uncanniness about the difference that women have that I think God has given them. She can detect a downcast glance from her teenage daughter or son. She can tell if her husband is carrying some frustration from his workday. Doesn't this make sense with God's design for a woman, the one he called helper? What a gift God has given to women. Now, this was very instructive for me as a husband, because areas where I might look at my wife and see like her compassionate nature and then kind of be looking down on it or despising it is something that's wrong with me. I should instead be encouraging that. That is an asset that my wife has that she should then be encouraged to utilize. And so this was very helpful for me as I worked through even thinking through the woman's strengths and then the man's strengths. However, this virtue can be made and turned into a vice. In Isaiah 3:12, this passage is not often mentioned, but it states, "As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. Oh, my people, those who lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths." Here, this passage is talking about the political realm. And this is fascinating to think through, especially in light of Lewis's quote. And I haven't processed through any of that, but from a biblical perspective, the Old Testament prioritized the rule of men. And so if men are supposed to be ruling, what would be the advantage? Well, what does the passage say? "As for my people, children are their oppressors." What do you need to do with an oppressor? You gotta fire that guy. You have to demote him.
Doge.
Wait. Redacted.
And then who is going to struggle to make that type of a decision? Well, I believe that we're seeing a little bit of a glimpse of the gender relations and their natural inclinations, and that men are going to be better suited. As a generalization, there's some men who don't do this well, and there's some women who do do this decently, okay? They do it well. But as a generalization, the men are going to be better suited to lead in this way. Okay, one more quote. Did you have something now? Okay, so one more quote. This is from Calvin Robinson in his article, "Canceled from Mere Anglicanism." He states, "Generally speaking, men tend to be more theologically rigid, whereas women tend to be more theologically flexible. That is because men do not have the emotional intelligence of women." I liked that phrase. We lack emotional intelligence. "We are more black and white, meaning we tend to be logic-based when it comes to problem-solving. Women tend to be more inclusive. They are more empathetic and tend to be more emotion-based when solving problems. You can see how that might be a problem when a group is claiming to be an oppressed minority, and the thing preventing them from attending church is the cruel doctrines and the regressive scriptures we follow. Which empath wouldn't want to compromise in order to make a so-called oppressed minority feel included?" And so what he is arguing for is that this is part of God's creature design, that men need to be the leaders, and then women need to be compassionate. We want them to be compassionate. But what that then demands of them is that they would then sometimes submit their compassion to the headship of their husbands. And where they may want to be compassionate, they may have to acknowledge that their husband is in a better situation to identify a perversion, and they then need to obey them. Now, I mean, I can't get into some of the details, but I've seen this at work, friends. Like, I've seen this at play in the real world. And so this is Tim Little's position, and you can speak against it or whatever else, but this is kind of where I'm at. And now I want to bolster this case a little differently. We looked at Genesis 3, and if we look at Genesis 3 and we think through Genesis 3:17, then to Adam, God said, "Because you have heeded or listened to the voice of your wife, if not eaten from the tree of which I have commanded you," all right? Let's look at another scenario where things kind of went awry. I want to go to Genesis 16. Charlie, can you read for us Genesis 16, 1 through 4?
"Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, 'Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her.' And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So After Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress.
Okay, here we go. Let's make some observations, shall we? Verse 3. Then Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband, Abram, to be his wife. Does that sound familiar?
What?
So just as Eve takes the fruit and gives it to her husband, so also does Sarai take Hagar and give her to her husband. Okay, now we're not done.
Verse 2.
Go ahead and read it, Charlie.
And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai.
It's the same construction as Genesis 3:17. There is a clear parallel between these two women and these two men. And in both instances, the men are being apathetic and they are listening to their wives, and they should have listened to God. Abram knew what was the right thing to do. He knew he shouldn't have done this, I would contend. Okay, like that's what Moses is communicating in the way that he has written this. Just as Adam knew it was wrong, Abram knew it was wrong. Where does it say that Abram can't create a child through another woman? Okay, that's not in chapters 12 through 15 at all. If you just work through Genesis 12 through 15, there's nothing they're doing wrong in Genesis 16. But is there? And the author is saying, yeah, you messed up. So Gordon Wenham, he makes the comment, the fact that the phrase obey, or literally listen to the voice, the whole phrase is exactly the same, occurs only here and in Genesis 3:17 would be suggestive on its own. But more than that, in both instances, it is a question of obeying one's wife, an action automatically suspect in the patriarchal society of ancient Israel. Okay, do you understand what this is communicating? All right. That this is more than a chance allusion to the fall seems to be confirmed by verse 3, where further echoes of the narrative are found. Okay, I have additional quotes here from Matthews and Waltke. I'm basically looking at all of the top commentaries, and guess what? Everybody knows it. Everybody sees it. And you walk away from Genesis 3 and Genesis 16, and it's essentially teaching men, guess what? Don't listen to your wife. Yikes.
I never do. About 1,000.
Now.
But the listen here, you've made a point that it's the obedience.
It is. So it's not Shema, like, to listen or to obey.
To obey. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so I have phrased it that way, to listen, because that's not my view, but that's where some people could take it.
Gotcha. Okay.
All right.
There you go.
And I'm setting up my next point.
Oh, nice. Okay.
All right. So we're going to go to one more text, and we're going to go to Genesis 20. So let's go to Genesis 20, and if we can read verses 8 through 13. Josh, can you read Genesis, is it 20 or 21? 21, I'm sorry. Genesis 21, verses 8 through 13.
And the child grew and was weaned, and Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned. But Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, laughing. So she said to Abraham, "Cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not be heir with my son Isaac." And the thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. But God said to Abraham, "Be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac shall your offspring be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman also, because he is your offspring."
Did you guys catch it? Do not let it be displeasing in your sight because of the lad or because of your bondwoman. Whatever Sarah has said to you, do it. You see, it's not that a woman should just be mute and not talk to her husband. She should be conversing. She should be talking. She should be suggesting. She should be doing all of that stuff. But guess what? Who's the head? He is. And what is it the guy's responsibility to do? To discern whether or not he should do it or not. You see, this passage isn't about, oh, well, do what I say, woman, go get my beer, all right? This passage is about, guys, you need to be godly. You need to be closer to God than to your wife, okay? You need to be spiritual so that when your wife is saying something that might be a little bit off, you then have the spiritual closeness to God to say, honey, I need you to trust me with this one. This relationship, we need to create some distance here. Trust me, and let's go forward in life.
That almost reminds me of Job, when his wife is like saying, curse God and die. And he's like, no, that's how the pagans speak. We don't speak that way, honey. Like, we don't do that. That almost sounds like a positive example.
I like that. I think you're right on. That's a really good positive example. And so what do we learn from genders in Genesis? Well, we learn what we've learned previously. Who's the one that's in charge? The man is the one that's in charge. Okay, so what is the woman's role in relationship to him? Well, she's the one that helps him, and she assists him in accomplishing the task that God places before him. What is a man's natural tendency? To be lazy. And so, because you're being lazy, then what does the woman have to do? She has to pick up the pieces, and she's the one that has to...
Yeah. Like, you don't make the decision. Somebody has to.
Somebody's got to.
Yeah. It's going to fall on her, and you can sit back and watch TV.
And so, instead, this is not a call, really, for our wives to be quiet. What it is it's a call for our men to be godly. And that's my encouragement to you. Man, you bear the responsibility of your family, okay? Whether you like it or not. If you're just like, well, she's not going to follow me. Well, how do you know? Have you ever asked her to do anything? Okay, and furthermore, what kind of an example are you? So just... You know, I've had to live this, okay? So, and it's not easy and it can be difficult. I'll give you one illustration. My wife said that I can use these various and sundry illustrations, okay? But there was one time, there was a book that I read. It was Deepak Raju. It was on pornography. I can't remember what the title was.
Rescue Plan.
Rescue Plan. Yeah. He has Rescue Plan and Rescue Skills. It was Rescue Plan. And he talked a fair amount about female pornography and how this is a significant issue and it's going to be growing. And so I wanted my wife to read this book. And it was, I suggested it to her. I didn't tell her, by the way. I asked her, I was like, hey, I think this would be like a good book for you to read. And she just didn't want to. And recognizably so, because my wife, she's had to read a lot of books about pornography or sex or whatever. And it's just kind of like, you know, one more. And I'm like, no, I think this one would be really good for you because this is an issue that you're probably going to have to be dealing with in the future. And she was still quite resistant to it. And then like a month passed and then I brought it up again and she was still very resistant to it. I talked to a good friend of mine even about it. And he was like, dude, you kind of demand a lot of your wife already. Maybe you need to chill a little bit. But like 3 weeks after that second time, a young lady wanted to meet with her. And guess what she wanted to talk to her about? Mm-hmm. You see, so it was really validating for me and helped me to understand my role. I'm not to be overbearing. I'm not to be demanding. I'm to be equipping. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to help her and equip her for the task that God would have for her. That's the picture. And then she has to agree to it. She has to follow. And so God's design is a good design. And a lot of times we think, well, God can never change her or you guy, okay? He's never going to change. Well, no, let's not shortchange God. I've seen God work. He does work. And he can work in your marriage too. Man, be the Christ-like man, not the overbearing man, not the apathetic man. Be the Christ-like man and lead in wisdom.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.